Chip.
Hey, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I'll be introducing Chris. Chris is one of the two best friends I've ever had. I think I've known him about 10 years, and we met in rehab when I moved out here, and we just became really close, and we definitely haven't stayed sober all the time, but and sometimes it's been me that's been out, sometimes it's been him that's been out, but I can tell you that he's always been there for me. You know, every time I've come back, he's a lot of times been the first person there, you know, to kind of help me through it. And he was out for a long time this last time, and I guess the times before when he was sober, he never, I would say, fully got involved in the steps, and this time it's been much different. He got involved in the steps, and now he just, I mean, he works with a ton of guys, and he's just a perfect example of what this program can do in your life, you know. So I'm really excited to hear what he has to say.
I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for the kind words, Mike. You know, it's kind of one of these things where, you know, I get whenever I'm asked to speak or really do anything, you know, especially anything that could potentially be helpful to someone, you know, I'm always inclined to say yes. But when it comes to do something like public speaking, I absolutely hate it. It makes me nervous, makes me uncomfortable. But I think at the same time, that's one of the you know, gifts, and one of the best things that I can do for my own personal program and stuff like that is to walk through the uncomfortability, because I think that's a lot what drives, you know, the need to drink and so forth, is, you know, how I act or react when I get in uncomfortable situations. And so it really is, in an uncomfortable way, a really cool thing to be able to do. And, you know, it's kind of a thing. What was actually really cool, right before Jerry ended up sending me a text message, I was actually, so I'm someone who, you know, is in a couple other fellowships as well, because I guess I'm just lucky, I reckon. But it's one of those things where I was trying to figure out, you know, where I fit in with Alcoholics Anonymous and so forth. And right when I was starting to take a look at that, you know, Jerry ended up sending me a text message. And, you know, I think that was one of those things where God just kind of gives you a little push to start figuring some stuff out. And I ended up talking to a few people. And the reason why I say that, so when I come up here, you know, like I said, I'm in a couple other fellowships, this primary purpose group. I want to talk about, you know, alcoholism and how it shows up in my life and so forth, and not really go down the rabbit hole of drugs and stuff like that. But, you know, I do kind of want to touch on this for a minute, because it is a thing where, you know, I'll start and think, well, maybe, you know, I'm truly just an addict, and, you know, alcohol was just a manifestation of that. And, you know, kind of what I found from talking to my sponsor, he helped me tremendously just explaining how drinking and stuff like that happens while you're on certain drugs and so forth. And, you know, kind of what I found as I'm able to look at my experience, you know, I am someone who, long before certain drugs that got me in different fellowships, that I was definitely alcoholic. I drank alcoholically. The allergy showed up. You know, the obsession was there and so forth. And I was really able to kind of get in touch and really look at that piece of it. And so, because it was a thing where I started wondering, well, maybe, you know, I shouldn't be going to AA meetings, you know. And what I found is, you know, I do fit in AA. And I think that was an important thing and a kind of an eye-opening thing for me to get into. So I'll kind of just start out. Last night I heard in this meeting, you know, it's going to be kind of something that's paraphrased, but I think she put it very eloquently and almost beautifully. You know, she said, you know, thank God for alcohol. You know, it took care of my alcohol, or it worked with my alcoholism in the beginning. And that's, you know, that's kind of what my experience shows. And so it's this thing where I've had this interesting kind of past. So I got my dad, he has 29 years sober. I literally grew up in AA meetings, and I literally kind of grew up being the little kid who's just sitting there disrupting your meetings, running around like a madman and stuff like that. And so, you know, I would go all the picnics and stuff like that, and I knew he was an alcoholic, and I knew I wasn't just supposed to go around and be like, hey, my dad's an alcoholic. I didn't understand why. I didn't understand what an alcoholic was. at that point, you know, I just knew that I would go to these places. He knew a lot of people, and everyone was super nice and super friendly, and that's all I knew about it. And it was kind of a thing where, you know, as I got a little bit older, you know, I started getting in a lot of trouble, you know, at a young age. So, you know, the first time I ever had a drink, I was 11 years old. I was up in Cleveland, Ohio, and, you know, I was hanging out with my cousin who was a few years older, and he was like, hey, you know, you want to steal a little bit of liquor from my parents and, you know, know nothing about alcohol or anything like that? I was like, absolutely, you know, and so we ended up stealing some Grey Goose, and, you know, we knew you could mix drinks and stuff like that, didn't know what to do or anything, so we ended up mixing it with Pepsi, and I couldn't drink Pepsi for about a good 4 or 5 years. I still really not a fan of Pepsi, and it was just, you know, what ended up happening was I had a blast. Me and my cousin had an absolute blast. We didn't do anything exciting. We were just in the basement drinking, just cracking up, cutting up, and stuff like that. And I just remember thinking, this is a really cool experience. And I remember the next day, you know, just being hungover, didn't fully understand it. Just remember we went to a Cleveland Indians game, and just every bump on the highway, it was just fighting the urge to puke. And, you know, kind of learned a valuable lesson that day that, you know, greasy food, ate chili dogs, hangover goes away. And, you know, so it was kind of a thing where, you know, I had such a good experience. It did something for me that day. I didn't fully understand what it did for me at that point in time. But, you know, so whenever people, you know, would ask me to drink again, I was completely fine with it. I was happy to do so. And, you know, not going down the rabbit hole of drugs, but when people, you know, offered drugs and stuff like that, I was very interested because it did something to me. And so when I was little, when I was 4 and 5 years old, you know, I ended up going through some sexual abuse and stuff like that. And that's, you know, one of the first things that, you know, really I was able to pick up and learn as it pertained to the alcohol and the drugs and so forth, that, you know, it fixed what I perceived was wrong with me. And so, you know, it had tremendous value in my life, even at a young age. And, you know, I didn't understand that exactly, that that's what it was doing or something like that. I just know life was better. You know, it was a thing of, you can hear, turn a song on the radio, you know, that you've heard 100 times, and, you know, you put some alcohol in your system, and then all of a sudden, you know, the song sounds almost new. It's, you start to get excited by it and stuff like that. That's how it reacts in my life. That's the first mental piece that really I can kind of link up with. And so it's kind of a thing where, you know, I start to realize that there's tremendous value, and I start getting in a lot of trouble. And I don't want to say like I was a bad kid or anything like that, but I was constantly in trouble. You know, by the time, you know, I was 14, I was constantly getting in trouble at school, around the neighborhood, you know, with my family. I got arrested for truancy, underage drinking, and then there was this whole thing of assaulting a federal employee. I just threw something out the window and hit a male lady in the head. I mean, it wasn't that big of a deal, but, you know, it was just kind of stuff like that. And so, you know, it really was a thing where I started going in front of judges, started going in front of my parents, started going, you know, in front of administrators and teachers at school, and, you know, they kind of all knew the deal. I mean, I looked how I looked. I looked like the quintessential alcoholic drug addict. You know, I had that vibe about me, and, you know, I kept having people tell me that, you know, that, you know, I have a drinking problem, that I have a drug problem, and I kept hearing all these things. And so, you know, my natural inclination was, you know, you hear that from about 20 different people, especially that young of an age, you know, I must be, but I didn't fully understand what that meant. And so, you know, people would tell me I'm an alcoholic, and I'd say, well, yes, I am. Don't know what that means, but, you know, I just remember I didn't understand. I didn't understand why I did the things I did. I didn't understand, you know, what this compulsion was or this obsession to drink was or anything like that. And so, you know, it really was kind of a thing of, you know, so I didn't understand it. But I knew that it had such value in my life, that it did things for me, that it did something for me. And I got sick and tired of getting in trouble. I got sick and tired of these, you know, punishments. And really, as far as I could tell, the only real consequence that I was getting was people telling me not to do it. And so it was a thing of, you know, I ended up running away twice because people weren't going to tell me how to drink. You know, as simple as this, and there was no good plan for it or anything like that. It, you know, never lasted too long. I remember, you know, one of the second time kind of what ended up happening is I ended up getting these 2 gallons of, it was imitation Mr. Boston's. It was Mr. Barton's vodka. It was like about $4.50 for a gallon of it. And so, you know, it was affordable. You know, it just burned when you drank it, but it got the job done. And so, you know, I didn't know I was going to go, but I wasn't going to let people tell me how to drink anymore. You know, 14 years old, I know what I'm doing. You know, absolutely not the truth, but, you know, that's the way that this delusion runs, and that's how it goes. And so, you know, I had a duffel bag, you know, I had some changes of clothes, had 2 gallons of vodka, I packed a bag of Fritos, and like maybe a couple other things. It was not a well thought out plan, you know. And so I end up going, I end up buying this 10 strip of acid, and I just spend, you know, 48 hours just drinking vodka, eating acid. No sleep, just absolutely insane, out of my mind. End up, you know, I was right near this elementary school, and I guess they were doing like some remodeling and stuff. So this dumpster full of carpet, and you know, that looked like a good place to like go and sleep, you know, after being up 48 hours all crazy. And then, you know, I just remember falling asleep for a little bit and, you know, seeing what looks like my dad walking up and being like, oh shit, you know. And of course it was him, and he took me home. At that point I was, you know, pretty beaten down and tired. And so, you know, I just remember, you know, my parents were scared, and that's, you know, at a young age, you know, I didn't want to make my parents feel this way. You know, there's a part in the doctor's opinion which talks about frothy a pill seldom suffices. And, you know, I started getting this frothy emotional pill, you know, like I said, definitely from my parents. You know, I got it from even from judges. I got it from DAs. I got it from teachers. I got it from neighbors. I got it from friends' parents. I got it from all these people. And, you know, they cared about me, and they were just trying to level with me and reason with me. And I didn't want to hurt these people. I absolutely did not want to hurt these people. But what I found is I hurt these people, whether or not, you know. And what I later came to find is that we really, you know, even though we don't want to, is we make people sick. In a lot of cases, in some cases, we make, you know, our loved ones sicker than even we are. And it's one of those things that, you know, kind of really, you know, starts to eat us up, because don't want to hurt these people, don't want to hurt these people, but yet I have to do what I have to do. And, you know, so just kind of read something real quick because it sums it up better. So the fact is, most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice and drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness sufficient force. The memory and suffering of humiliation of even a week or a month ago, we were without defense against the first drink, you know. And the first time I heard that, you know, I really could link up with that. Certain times could not bring into consciousness with sufficient force of the memory and suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago, because, you know, there'd even be times where I'm tired of hurting these people, I'm just going to quit. But yet, you know, there I am, I'm drinking again, I'm back out doing what I do, even at a young age. And someone told me that, because I started getting mandated to AA meetings at 14 years old. And so I was very young, and, you know, my experience was I had no clue what anyone was talking about. Not one single clue. I'd go to the meetings. Once again, I remember everyone was super friendly, everyone was kind, and people would try to talk to me, but I did not understand. You know, I think it was not so much intellectually I didn't understand what they were saying, it was that emotional, that internal piece I didn't understand, I couldn't relate with. You know, they would say, well, you kind of sound alcoholic, and, you know, all I knew is there was something wrong, and I didn't know what it was that was wrong at that point. And I still had that piece where, you know, the alcohol and the drugs did a lot for me, you know. And how do you shake something like that? Because, you know, in the beginning and for, you know, some years, it had a lot of value in my life. You know, it was really what was able to keep me going. And I think a lot of cases, it's what kept me from killing myself. You know, that has to have a lot of value. At that point, you know, I was getting consequences, but it hadn't completely turned on me. And, you know, the part that I never understood until somewhat recently is, you know, the first sentence and the last sentence of that paragraph. The fact is, most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, has lost the power of choice and drink. And then we're without defense against the first drink. And, you know, I never understood that. Even times, you know, past when I had gotten sober, I've always thought that, you know, I somewhat had a choice in this. And, you know, I really hoped that I somewhat had a choice in it. But kind of the beautiful thing is I'm actually fortunate that I'm without choice. You know, a little bit later it talks about lack of power. That was our dilemma. You know, I have no power. And, you know, I always perceive that to be a problem. And the truth of it is, you know, it's a blessing because I don't have to do anything. All I got to do is get in, you know, conscious contact with God, and He does it for me. So all I got to do is seek, and that's one of those, you know, beautiful things that you don't understand until you fully understand. And so, you know, kind of just moving forward, you know, I drank the way that I drank, and there were some things, you know, Big Book talks about, you know, incomprehensible demoralization. You know, that's something every alcoholic, you know, truly understands. And, you know, so I'll tell this story. It's kind of an embarrassing story, but I think it really kind of breaks into that, you know. So, and I think it also goes to the part where, you know, I do not always have control how much I drink when I drink, you know. And I think that's a big piece of it, and that's, you know, the big part of the allergy is because how many times, you know, did I only mean to get, you know, just enough drinks to start to feel right, to start to act right, you know, because another way that the alcohol and stuff worked in my life is, you know, at that point, I got comfortable. It made me comfortable. We drink for the effect. And what would also happen is, you know, I could talk to girls. I could kind of, you know, meet a bunch of different people. I wasn't, you know, so tense and tight. You know, that's one of the main things alcohol did for me. And so, you know, there'd be times where I just only intend to have, you know, I intend to have some drinks, you know, not get completely belligerent. So, you know, one of the things that I did is I meant to have a few drinks, went to this party, ended up, you know, throughout the course, had about 24 beers. Did not black out, you know, but I was so drunk I literally could not speak. And I spent the whole time at this party, you know, and did not intend to get this drunk. And I couldn't speak, so the only thing I could do was I just sat there and everyone would come talk to me. And what would happen is I would try to talk and it would just... And literally no one could understand me. And so I got really frustrated. So I would just say, hey. So, you know, it's been about 14 years since then. I still run into some people every now and then from my side of town. And when they see me, they just go, hey. You know, it's just stupid little things like that, you know. And there's this other time where, you know, meant to just go out, have a few drinks, and got completely lit up, you know, blacked out. And I don't know, ended up pantsless at a party for a couple hours, drove home, you know, half naked, woke up, and tried to figure out what the hell happened to my pants and stuff. You know, that's, and I find out the next day, you know, when I start calling around, it's like, you know, I never meant to get that drunk. I never meant to do that stuff either, but that's that incomprehensible demoralization. That's kind of the part we go to. And so, you know, when you really look at it, so, you know, we got the obsession of mind, the allergy, and the spiritual malady, and it's this thing where, you know, that allergy takes hold, you know, even though I plan on having some drinks, even though I plan on getting a little bit loose, I never know what's going to happen. You know, I never know if I'm, yeah, I never know what's exactly is going to happen with that. And then, you know, what happens when I don't have the drink, you know, because I'm drinking for an effect. I'm drinking for it to change my perception of how I perceive myself. And, you know, a lot of times, I also drink to change you. I don't actually change you, but I change my perception of you. And so that's, you know, the value that this had in my life. And so, you know, what ends up happening is, you know, when I would go to treatment, when I would try to sober up, what I learned is, you know, I had this dream that, you know, once I start having all these consequences, once I have all these things going, I have this dream that if I just get sober, everything is going to be great. Everything's going to work out, you know, work, everything. And what I find is you remove the chemicals from me, everything gets worse. You know, at that point, you know, and I think that's one of the, you know, true main characteristics, you know, with an alcoholic is what happens when you remove the alcoholic, what happens when you remove the drugs and so forth, is instead of everything get better, you know, everything gets worse. I hate myself. I hate everyone. You know, it's this thing where I'm expecting that all my problems are just going to go away. And for years and years, I was told that I have a drinking problem. And that's, you know, the logical sense. And then someone kind of just flipped it on me and said, no, it sounds like you have a drinking solution. And, you know, that's when I was able to actually explore and look at, you know, the value that it had in my life. And it had such value for such time and so forth. And then, you know, on page 52, I think they kind of really explained this better, the best, because this is what happens, you know, when I quit. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. You know, those bedevilments, that is what happens when I quit drinking. And, you know, I think you could probably, you know, add some of your own with what happens. And so that's one of the main reason why I drink. And that's, you know, to me, that's what happens with the spiritual malady. That's what drives the obsession. That's why I have to get, you know, I used to call it get right, you know. And the truth is, I don't actually get right. I just take care of that. And that's, you know, what my drinking solution, my drug solution, that's what it's all about. And it's really, it's crazy when you start to think about it. So I'm a guy who just knew that I had all these problems and stuff like that, and I just kept hoping that, you know, maybe if I get older, everything will work itself out, you know, just maybe. And what would happen is I would get older and things would not work their way out. And so, like I said, I started getting mandated meetings, you know, 14 years old. So I've literally spent years trying to reinvent the wheel, trying to figure out a way to not do it the way that I've been being told the whole time. And I was doing it so I would not have to spend my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what ended up happening is I've spent my life in Alcoholics Anonymous and with nothing to show for it. And so, you know, when you kind of look at that, that's just kind of maddening. And so, you know, I ended up going to treatment when I was 22, got off in a real bad way, you know, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't think about getting sober. I just knew something had to change. You know, my parents said, hey, what about treatment? And, you know, it was like this revolutionary idea, you know, because it never crossed my mind. Never, nothing about the 12 steps, even though I spent years getting mandated meetings, never crossed my mind. So I said, you know, that's what I'm going to do. And so, you know, I ended up putting some time together. And, you know, I'm just going to say this. I ended up with right at about 6 years. And, you know, about as dry can get while being, you know, that amount of time. And kind of, you know, there was some periods of time where I was actually happy with it. And there was some periods, and, you know, I was actually, I wasn't doing much, but I was at least doing something, you know, here and there. And, you know, I did end up going through the steps. So I did about as half measures as you could. You know, it was enough to, I don't know, bring about sobriety, but bring about some abstinence. And, you know, the reason why I bring this up, because, you know, that was such a different experience from this time around. You know, huge difference. And, you know, to me, that's one of the big things is, you know, I don't want to, when I come to meetings, I don't want to shy away from God. I don't want to shy away from the book and stuff like that. It's just because there's been such a tremendous experience from past times to this times. And, you know, the main difference is, you know, when I went to treatment this last time, you know, I went through the steps. I did them as it was directed in the books, and a profound change happened. And it's absolutely insane. It's absolutely insane that, you know, never even thought about doing that, you know, through all those years and stuff. And so, you know, it was kind of a thing of, I would go back out, I would come back in. I did that for years and years. And, you know, I would keep hearing these things, you know, keep coming back to meetings, you know, think your way through the drink, you know, don't get high no matter what. I mean, there's all these things. And so that's the stuff I would try. I would absolutely try to think my way through the drink. You know, I would try to play that tape all the way through. But going back to what I read earlier on page 24, I'm without defense, you know, and it says, at certain times, I will be unable to recall with sufficient force. And that's what's important. That's the piece that, you know, I missed for years because I would try all these things. I would go to all these meetings and, you know, I would hear stuff. And I just kind of want to clarify, I'm not hating on meetings. I'm a big fan of meetings. It's just certain things, you know, in meetings that I've been told that I've tried and it happened to no avail. And that's kind of what I wanted to highlight at this point. You know, and so I would hear these things, meeting makers make it. And, you know, so that's what I would do. I would go to all these meetings and I would never make it. I would be drunk again. I would be high again. I wouldn't understand why. And be like, well, I'm doing it. And, you know, occasionally someone would say, well, why don't you work the steps? And like, no, you know, and so that was a big piece of it. And it's like, so I got this experience where I'm going to come to your meetings, I'm going to do absolutely nothing, and then I'm going to completely blame y'all and act like y'all are absolutely insane. You know, and I see people do this all the time, and I love them for it, because I get that, because I have that experience. And, you know, it really is this thing where, you know, what am I doing? What am I doing with my daily life? What am I doing, you know, when I come in here? What do I expect? You know, it's been this thing where, you know, I take a few drinks or whatever, and what happens is something, you know, starts to happen in me. I come in here, you know, you remove that from me. I get sober for a reason, because shit's getting bad. And it's not just getting bad with the outside stuff. You know, it's getting bad internally, where even the drink is not going to take care of these bedevilments. That's why I get sober. That's why I have this dream to get sober. And what ends up happening is I come to these meetings and I want you to fix me, but I'm not willing to do the work in it. And then I get very resentful and I get very upset. All right. But then I'll do some stuff, you know, I'll really start focusing on these. It was explained to me as back problems, you know, get the car back, get the job back, you know, get the woman back, get the family, you know, happy with you again. I do all these things. And, you know, this is another one of my fantasies and another one of my dreams, that if I do these things, you know, everything is going to be great. You know, everything, I'm going to be happy. And so I start doing these things. I get these things. I've gotten really good at getting all these things back because I've had a lot of practice with it. But what ends up happening is it doesn't fix anything. You know, my internal condition is still absolute shit. You know, and that's just the way I feel. And I'm sitting there, you know, completely baffled, being like, but I did all these things, you know, I should be all shiny, I should look like something really shiny, life should be really great because I made these outside issues happen. And I would never think to, you know, look at that internal condition. And, you know, kind of where stuff started to flip is, you know, people started telling me to seek. I wasn't sure exactly what to seek. People would say, well, start seeking God. And, you know, I wouldn't understand, well, how do you seek God? And, you know, one of the most amazing things that I heard, there was a speaker, Joe Hock, and I think he, you know, puts it very eloquently. You know, he asked the question, you know, would you rather have consciousness or conception? And, you know, all this time, you know, I would spend a bunch of time trying to figure out conception. I would think that, you know, if I only understood what God was, who he was, what he looked like, whatever, you know, then it would be a lot easier to take that third step decision and, you know, make that decision, turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. And what I found is when I sit there and I try to figure out all these questions about God, the only thing that happens is my head wants to explode. You know, and it's been a thing where I just kind of had to learn that that's above my pay grade. You know, I'm not supposed to understand all those things. But as I start to seek, as I start to, you know, one of the earliest truths I could find about God was, you know, the people in meetings who would talk about God, you know, those were generally the people who, A, were staying sober, and those were generally the people who were happy while being sober. Because I got experience with being sober, but I would really call it abstinent, and being absolutely miserable. But the people who you could just tell, just from how they were, their body language, you just tell that even every bit of their soul, they were, you know, truly a happy person. Those were the people talking about God in meetings. And, you know, I I spent several years, you know, trying to disprove why that was, you know, because if I could just find out why that's bullshit, then, you know, it would give me free will to do whatever I want, you know, and that's the one thing that I've never been able to disprove, and so that's really the first truth that I've ever been able to see about God, and, you know, I think that was the first way where I'm able to actually start to seek, you know, and I can actually start to, so you can't get sober by osmosis. You know, me hanging out with a bunch of sober people will not give me sobriety. But what I can by hanging out with people in sobriety is I can see what they do, how they act, how they react in situations, who they are, how they live their life, you know, what truths, you know, they found about God, how, you know, God works in their life, how sobriety works in their life. And, you know, that's kind of one of those little game changers, because, you know, we can learn from everyone. And there's been times where, you know, I can go in meetings, you know, I'm very happy that this time around I got hooked up and turned on to the set-aside prayer, because that's one of the things I need to set aside, what I perceive meaning should look like, how people should act in meaning, how people should share, talk, and stuff like that. And kind of one of the things that I learned was I never know who God's going to use to be a vessel. I never know who God's going to have speak directly to me. And, you know, some of the times it's the most crazy person who has some of the most profound shit to say. And some of the times I've been that guy who's that crazy person, too. And so that's kind of one of those big things to look at. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I also got to set aside, you know, what I think I know and what I think I understand about God. You know, because I found that no one's really going to, you know, I'm the one that kind of dictates what God can and can't do. You know, and so that's one of those things that I got to set aside to be able to see the truth and how he works and so forth in my life. And, you know, it's been a crazy kind of journey, but it's also this part where, you know, Big Book talks about God doesn't make too hard of terms to those who seek. You know, so all I got to do is be able to start putting, you know, in some footwork. And what I learned is, you know, when I start doing the steps and when I start doing the steps as outlined in the Big Book, what ends up happening, you know, I kind of follow these simple mechanics and stuff. What ends up happening is, you know, I start to kind of split open. And it's so much of a thing of I can start to actually, you know, live up to that. And so I ended up getting sober this last time. I went to this really amazing 12-step immersion place out in Alabama, and just had an eye-opening experience with that place and so forth. And, you know, I came back, you know, and this was the first time that I hadn't lost everything. I've gotten really good at burning things to the ground and rebuilding them. You know, I'm really good at those back problems and so forth. And, you know, I was kind of pumped that this was, you know, I ended up getting mandated by the courts. And, you know, didn't necessarily want to be sober, but, you know, and this is how the powerlessness comes to play in my life. You know, I went in front of the judge, can you pass drug test? No. Come back in a few weeks, you know, set a new court date. Hey, can you pass that drug? No. You know, come back in a few weeks, you know, can you pass drug test? Maybe, but no. You know, okay, well, you got to go to treatment or jail. And, you know, of course, you're going to choose treatment. That's the plush way to do it. And, you know, that, and the reason why I bring that up is, you know, because that man who I wanted to be really resentful and hate, he gave me, you know, essentially three options, you know, to at least try to prove to the courts, to him, to myself, to whoever, that I was not alcoholic or addict or anything like that. And, you know, that's one of those things where it's so frustrating, because I was doing everything in my absolute willpower, you know, and like to highlight the word willpower in the situation, you know, to be able to pass a drug test, you know, to be able to go in front of that judge and be like, we're good, you know, because this was it wasn't even a charge, it was a ticket, it literally was a ticket for disorderly conduct. It should have been just pay, and, you know, he knew what the deal was and stuff like that, and he gave me every opportunity to just be able to take a drug test and pay a ticket and go about my life, you know. And, you know, I just cannot do that for whatever reason. And, you know, and that's kind of the stuff going back to, we are without choice, we are without defense, you know, because it didn't matter what I did. And, you know, I think I'm like most people, you know, we try a bunch of different things, you know, a bunch of different ways to get sober. You know, and I kept trying to expect certain things to fix me, you know, and what that can look like is, you know, going to see a doctor, you know, going to get on different medications. You know, it can be, if I get this job, I'll stay sober and, you know, I'll stay away from everything. You know, at one point, you know, tried to get into the Marines. They wouldn't take me. One of those little drug test issues again. And then about a year later, tried to do the Army because I figured it's easier getting the Army than the Marines. Same thing. But because I was just thinking, well, I just need a little bit more discipline, you know, and these are the rationales that we come across, and this is me trying to exert my willpower or exert my human aid, and they do a beautiful job, you know, in the first, really the first 50 pages, you know, just going into, you know, that we are beyond human aid. And at that point, when I can start to see that, hey, I've tried, you know, even though for years I've been told to try, hey, just try program A, these 12 steps. I've been trying to do B through Z, you know, multiple times, try to figure out a different way, reinvent the wheel, and do all this stuff. And what ends up happening is I can't do that, you know. No matter what, I can't reinvent the wheel. That stuff does not work for me, you know. And so going back to what I was talking about before, was, you know, so I went to this treatment center, you know, probably the only thing I did right before going into there is, you know, I made a promise to my fiance that, you know, I was going to come back the best, I was going to go there and be the best Chris I can be and come back to be the best Chris that I can be. And, you know, there really was this part where I really meant it. I was sick of it. You know, I had enough time with that fantasy that if you remove the alcohol and so forth, that everything would get better. I knew that just wasn't going to be the case for me this time, because it wasn't the case for me the last 10, 15 times, whatever. And so, you know, I go to treatment, and I was very, you know, actually I was pretty grateful to be there and so forth. And, you know, there's a reason why I tell the story I'm about to tell. It's not to make Kelsey uncomfortable, which it kind of does. But it's more of a thing of what happens, you know, what the gifts of the program look like and what actually happens, you know, when you do the steps and you get in a tight situation. Yeah, I can tell the story, right? Okay. So, you know, I was going to treatment. I was getting mandated, you know. She was going to use her willpower and get sober. And, of course, you know, that didn't happen. And so, you know, I had to be there for 3 months. You know, 2 months into it, it was Christmas time. You know, I actually got a pass to come back for a couple days. And, you know, at that point, you know, she was very, very physically sick, you know, still trying to use that willpower. And, you know, everything was looking good. We had, you know, money, still had the car, still had the apartment, still had everything. You know, Christmas was kind of a shit show. I'm not going to get too much into that. But then I come back and, you know, I know something's wrong that last month that I'm talking to her on the phone. I know something's wrong, you know. But there's this part where, you know, my gut, everything in my gut, and to me, the gut is the God consciousness. That's how that talks about in the 10th or the 11th step. And, you know, I just knew in the gut doesn't lie to me. But, you know, my brain would just sit there and tell these lies, be like, no, everything's on the up and up. You know, it's just because of this and that. I would make up all these excuses. You know, and then about a week before I leave treatment, you know, say, hey, is there anything you want to tell me? And she's like, oh, no, everything's great. And, you know, so literally she comes and gets me, and I find out that, you know, she was not sober. And so I'm literally coming out of treatment, you know, and car's in the process of getting repoed, apartment getting evicted. There was about 10 grand. Before the month before, now there's like about $43, and 20 of it has to go in the gas tank. You know, got to get her into treatment, have absolutely no idea, you know, what I'm going to do. And it was just one of those things where, you know, fear started to kick in, a little bit of anger started to kick in too, and I just completely like shut down. And so we drove back from Alabama, and like for like, you know, an hour, didn't say a word. And then, you know, kind of what happened after about an hour, I just kind of started cracking up laughing because I just had to kind of appreciate the insanity of what was going on. And it was this thing of, you know, I cannot blame her for something that I've done. You know, I can't blame her for something that I would do too. And, you know, so we get back and spend about, you know, the first couple of days trying to get her into a place of treatment, you know, A, and B, also, you know, selling pretty much everything else we have left to kind of be able to get her somewhere. And, you know, so I had all this shit going on, you know, my whole, what I view as my world is crumbling upon me. But what I found is it wasn't about me. You know, those 2 days, even though everything was, you know, gone to shit, you know, it was about her. How can I help her? And, you know, there's literally just paraphernalia, all different kinds of stuff all over the apartment, you know, throwing that stuff away. But what happened, and I think this is a direct result of being through the steps to that point, is, you know, those are probably the two easiest days of sobriety I've ever had, because it wasn't about me. None of that stuff was about me, and it was very confusing, and it was actually kind of scary, you know, when that realization happened that, you know, this isn't about me and things are going good. And, you know, first thing I did when I got back in town was I went to a meeting. You know, I got a sponsor after that meeting. You know, he was a temporary sponsor, but I started using him. You know, I made a point that I was going to go to a meeting every single day. I had some people that I was talking to every single day. I was making people aware of what my situation was, you know, and it was a thing of I was going to God with this stuff. And, you know, as it talks about in the 10-step promises, I was in a place of neutrality. I was safe and protected. I was in, you know, a bad situation, you know, with 1,000 different excuses and reasons for me to just get high or to get drunk, whatever the case may be. And, you know, what I found was those 10-step promises were absolutely true. And it's one of those things where when you sit back and look at it, it's just one of those wow-type situations. So all the stuff I've been hearing for years and years that I've been shying away and been trying to come up with all these reasons why it's bullshit is 100% true, and that I've just been delusional the whole time. And you get to see the stuff, you know, actually happen, and you get to see the stuff practically work, you know, in my life, you know, in my experience. And, you know, what ends up happening is I get to take an experience like that, and it becomes a powerful experience to be able to help others. You know, there's been, you know, I got a buddy who went through pretty much a similar situation with that, and, you know, I was able to kind of tell my experience and was able to help him. And one of the things that I learned is all these bad things that happen in life, all these crazy things that happen, you know, even though I would get upset with them and so forth, what ends up happening is all these things have a silver lining. You know, one of the things that I learned, I think, is kind of the psychic change and the spiritual awakening, is when bad shit happens in my life nowadays, I'm not happy that it's happening at the time that it's happening, but what ends up happening is there is always the silver lining to it. And when I can look back in the rearview mirror, that I can see that it's a blessing, that there's a reason for it to happen. There was a lesson there. There was a way to learn. You know, I get to learn about more about myself, you know, as I handle these things. And, you know, I'm able to look at things like in the 10th step, you know, the watch, ask, turn part. You know, watch for fear, resentment, self-centeredness, and dishonesty to crop up, you know, and then it tells me ask God to remove it at once, talk to someone, and turn to someone I can help, you know. And I think, to me, the part that really resonates is that word turn, because, you know, anytime any kind of uncomfortability or anything like that happened, I would turn to alcohol, I would turn to drugs, I would turn to whatever that I would think would temporarily fix my solution or whatever. And what I learned is, you know, I had to find a new solution. You know, the alcohol solution stopped working. And so, you know, what the solution has been God. And, you know, I'm not going to be one who thinks, you know, I understand what God's will is or anything like that, but I have learned that, you know, God's will has always been for me to help people whenever available. And it's one of those things that, you know, when I kind of work with that watch, ass, turn, you know, when stuff starts to get crazy, you know, God always puts someone for me to make that turn to actually be able to help. And it's just weird. And, you know, there was a time where I would have loved to chalk a lot of stuff up to coincidences, but, you know, you can only have too many coincidences. You know, just everything just fall to into line and stuff like that to say, hey, that's just coincidental. I'm just the luckiest guy ever. And if you look at my track record, I'm not the luckiest guy ever. You know, so I don't think that it's that. And so, you know, we really get to kind of look. And so, you know, I absolutely love just the reading from page 84 and 88 because it's really, you know, been kind of explained to me in a way that I've never heard before this time around. And there is just, you know, kind of what happens with it. And, you know, I got some friends who are huge into meditation. You know, it's something I do and absolutely practice. But, you know, I'm not Tarek. I don't do it for an hour a day. But, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, I kind of just try, well, what does the book say? The book says, you know, meditate before prayer. And what I learned is, you know, I can quiet the mind down enough and I can pray. And I absolutely feel hooked up. After, you know, I leave meditation and prayer in the morning, I do it, you know, within the first few minutes. And, you know, there's been unbelievable things that happen with it. But at the same time, you know, there's no denial that there is some sort of power working in my life, that there is a higher power, because I can absolutely feel him. You know, I can absolutely feel it when I leave meditation and prayer. But then what happens is, as soon as I leave there, life starts happening. And that's when, going back to that watch-ass turn stuff, you know, that fear, resentment, self-centeredness, and dishonesty crops up. And, you know, I kind of love that it says crops up because, you know, that tells me when these things come up and it tells us how to take care of it. And, you know, the other time, you know, a little bit earlier when it's talking about inventory stuff, you know, it uses words like driven. And mainly they're talking about driven by fear in that case, with a four-step reading. But what ends up happening is if these things crop up, I'm driven by them. And the way that, you know, I see driven to be is those situations and those times where you do something, you either react or you take some action, and, you know, whoever it is looks at you and just sit there and be like, what the hell's wrong with you? And then, you know, you're just sitting there like, I don't know. You know, those are the times where it becomes very obvious that I was driven to act in a way and so forth that I normally wouldn't. And so, I mean, that's just the craziness of how this stuff goes, because I never know how anything's going to look like. I never know how life's going to look like. I never know how my day's going to look like. And that's, you know, some of the most exciting stuff, where that used to be the stuff that would absolutely terrify me. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. And now it's kind of, you know, I don't know what happened, but it's probably going to be cool. And if it's not cool, you know, I've been given the tools to the best of my ability to be able to deal with this. And, you know, it's really been a thing of, you know, I got an amazing sponsor. I got an amazing network. I got people that I can call for just about anything. If anything, you know, is happening in my life that I don't know how to handle or I'm baffled with, or sometimes I even just want to vent, you know, there's people that I can talk to, and there's people who, you know, absolutely will tell me the truth. People who will absolutely, you know, give me good guidance. And, you know, it's crazy because I'm someone who, you know, when I'm out there drinking and stuff, what ends up happening is I'm a recluse. I don't want to be around anyone. You know, I'm a fade away from everyone that I completely can, you know. And I used to, in my great delusions, I used to look at it as I'm doing these people a favor so they don't have to, you know, deal with me. But really, it's I can't face people. You know, that's what happens initially, especially when I first get sober. I can't face people. You know, how am I supposed to go to work? How am I supposed to have conversations? How am I supposed to talk to people? How am I supposed to face these people? How am I supposed to face the day without the alcohol and the drugs in my system? You know, and you know, what I found is that stuff goes away, and you see a lot of that with the 9-step promises, you know. And so I read the bedevilments, you know, earlier, and what happens is the 9-step promises are the exact opposite of those bedevilments. You know, I can't make a living. Well, you know, talks about fear of economic insecurity goes away. You know, so for each one of those, there's the preceding thing. And, you know, it's one of those most amazing things where, like I said, you know, for a guy like me, you know, I've tried everything under the sun, you know, for many years, but the 12 steps, and would not get sober. And what really happened in my experience is, you know, I did the 12 steps. I did the way that they were directed. I did not try to make my own twist to it. And, you know, all these promises that go with each step came true in my life. And what ended up happening is, you know, a guy like me is not supposed to be sober, and a guy like me is definitely not supposed to be happy while being sober. But my experience is I am, in fact, sober, and I'm happy while being sober, and it's absolutely insane that that happened, because that doesn't happen to guys like me. You know, I thought I was a, well, I hope something works out, but I'm going on to the bitter end, you know. That's just kind of the reality, you know. It talks about, you know, the alcoholic life seems, or tends to be the only normal life, you know. That's how we tend to perceive it, that's how we tend to go with it. And, you know, there's this part where I really love with the 11-step promises, and, you know, to go back to that meditation and prayer, you know, it talks about, we are then much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, and foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And, you know, you start to look at the reading for the actor in the third step, you know, to really get you set up to be able to make that third step decision. Well, how am I trying to control the show? How am I trying to get people to act? You know, how am I trying to make people act a certain way and even say certain things without me even telling them that that's what I want, but they should do this because I think that's the way it should be done. And, you know, that's the insanity of us is, you know, we come up with these ideas that this is the way it should be. They're just supposed to know. I won't dare tell them or anything like that, but then I'm going to get upset, I'm going to get pissed at them, I'm going to get uncomfortable, and that's the stuff that I turn back to my alcohol solution with. And, you know, and it starts to talk about that, you know, with the 11 step, you know, to when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And, you know, the other big thing about with the actor, it talks about, you know, basically we're trying to create utopia. This isn't just good for me. This is going to be great for y'all, too, if you just act accordingly. And what ends up happening is that just doesn't happen. And that's the biggest thing about, you know, prayer and meditation is, you know, trying to get, you know, less of me involved. You know, and that's what meditation and prayer has done is, you know, to try to remove as much of my ego and what I think should happen as humanly possible. And like I said, you know, those were the two easiest days being sober because it wasn't about me. You know, I wish I could tell you that I found a way to mimic that in my day-to-day life, but I absolutely haven't. You know, there's still times where I want to react to people and so forth. You know, and I got a sponsee. He said something the other day that I absolutely loved, and, you know, he was talking about, you know, God doesn't remove his defects because it shows him that he still needs God. And I was just kind of like, well, you sponsor me, you know. But that's kind of the thing of, you know, how this shows up, because I do need to, you know, from time to time, I think I do need to, you know, fall down, bust my knees, and, you know, because there's times where, you know, I want to get back into that, I'm doing this, you know, and that's the times where I get in trouble, that's the times where I start to think that, you know, I'm kind of running the show, and that's the times where I will start to think that, you know, I am with choice. And so once again, you know, it is a thing of I'm without choice. It really is a thing. And, you know, I do not do these things perfect. You know, one of the things that recently I've struggled with is, you know, neither of you do it about half the time in the week. You know, for whatever reason, at times I just feel that that's optional. And that's a bad thing for a guy like me is when things start to become optional. I say that to kind of tell on myself, you know, because that's the kind of motivation that I need, you know, because if I think people will view me one way or another, it's always been the motivation to peer pressure. But, you know, so I don't do these things perfect, but I do, to the most part, try to do this stuff to the best of my ability. And so I screw up, and it's important that I screw up. But at the same time, you know, what I found that is when I try, and when I really do try to the best of my ability, you know, it's always has, and always, I do believe that it always will be good enough. You know, and that's, there's just certain things that, you know, sometimes I don't need to be perfect, and I almost at times expected, you know, these steps to make me perfect, my life to be perfect, and everything to be perfect. And, you know, what I found is, you know, when things aren't perfect, sometimes they're just happening the way they're supposed to be, and all I got to do is sit down, shut up, and let it happen, and it works out for the best anyways. You know, but with that, I appreciate y'all coming and listening to me, and I'll end. Thank you.